It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. More than half of Wisconsin's child care providers are operating below capacity. That's according to a new report from the State Department of Children and Families. A common reason for that? Not enough staff.
And the child care search site Winnie says Wisconsin families pay on average about 14% of their income to child care. That's roughly double the recommended average of 7%.
We're taking a look at the double bind in the childcare field, how to pay enough to bring staff on board while not getting too expensive for parents to afford. Paula Drew directs early care and education policy and research for the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. Paula, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
All right. This report, Paula, from the Department of Children and Families finds providers could care for 30,000 more children if they filled unused capacity. What are the challenges for these child care providers reaching their full, at least theoretical, capacity for the number of kids they take care of?
Yeah, so I think you hit the nail on the head already. It's a staffing issue, and it's ultimately a revenue issue. The sector primarily operates on parent fees. As you also mentioned, parents are paying about as much as they possibly can already, and it's not enough. It's a broken market system. Our calculations point to about needing 4,000 more teachers to fill that gap, to fill those seats that are open right now.
And a quandary here is to bring in these trained teachers. You have to pay them, of course, and there's a double bind. You ought to pay them enough to bring them in, but as I mentioned, not price parents out of the market. Are we anywhere near that, or is this something that isn't going to solve itself without some kind of outside help?
We believe that this will not be solved without outside help. I think parents cannot pay more, and we're seeing providers close because they cannot fill those financial gaps. And you're right, the average wage for an educator, you know, is about half as much as the average Wisconsin worker makes. So if you can work down the street at a Quick Trip or a McDonald's and make more and probably get benefits, you're likely going to make that choice for your own family. And that's why our classrooms are going unfilled. It's not something that can't be solved without public funding. And, you know, I think it's interesting that children are born learning, right? Their brains are more active in their development up until the age of five, yet we don't start funding education until children are four or five. And it's time Wisconsin starts investing in our youngest citizens.
Let's get a firsthand perspective now. Corrine Hendrickson is a family child care provider based in New Glarus. She operates Corrine's Little Explorers and provides preschool services, full-time child care, and education. Corrine, thanks a lot for joining us, I believe, from your preschool right now.
Yes, thank you very much for having me. I do have a substitute, so she's with the children at the moment.
Thank you for letting us know. I think people would have wondered. That is great to know. Now, Corrine, we've been talking with Paula here about these staffing challenges. Is this something that you see, this difficulty being able to draw in maybe as many childcare workers as you'd like to?
Yes, definitely. So for myself as a family child care professional, the very first time we ever received any sort of other revenue besides that was above and beyond what we charge for tuition, besides very few things, was during COVID pandemic. And that was the very first time that my household family income was stabilized. That was the first time that I could buy my kids their clothes when they needed them, instead of trying to figure, okay, how can I play this game so I can go get their clothes and pay the bill off next month? And so that was huge. And the reason that that's never happened was because, as Paula was saying, I cannot charge enough tuition to pay myself a decent wage. For all the hours I work and, you know, with the children, I'm with kids for 50 hours. That's another piece people forget. We have to care for the children while their parents are commuting and have lunch breaks. And so they're in care for about 10 hours a day. And we need to be able to pay ourselves and our teachers that much. And so this last year, after we lost the federal funding and our state refused to continue it in the budget with our state funds, I had to incrementally raise my rates. They're $70 more a week than they were a year ago. I am pricing out of families. I have never had problems filling my slots before, But this year, it was the week before September 1st when I had three openings that got filled that week. And that was frightening because then I was looking at, well, if I can't operate with only five children, I won't be able to pay my bills. So I started looking for other jobs because I couldn't, you know, I can't justify putting my family into bankruptcy or losing my home if I can't fill spots. And I had several people looking and several people asking, but I would send them my contract and rates and they were like, I can't pay that. It's too much. And so even my child on subsidy, she pays half of my tuition because our subsidy is so poor in this state that we are not meeting the financial obligations that we have set out when we take the federal money for that. And so it's affecting everyone, our lowest income, our middle income. The only people that are left that really can afford quality care are those who are in the higher socioeconomic status. And so we need that public investment to help offset that. All the other countries around us do it. You know, more and more investing more and more because they're understanding it's the brain development. It's that caring, nurturing relationship. Smaller group sizes are what we need so that we can meet these kids' needs, especially as more and more having special needs. And they should be included in our programs, but we can't support them if we don't have the lower ratios or the high quality teachers to do that.
And Paula, Corrine mentioned, you know, she's basically on the edge here of being able to stay open as a business. How common is it that we're seeing people in maybe Corrine's position saying, you know what, I love this work, but it just doesn't work anymore?
I hear that same story almost every day, Rob. And honestly, I was not surprised at all when I read this report. But, you know, what visually I was imagining while reading it was sort of like a store with a bunch of empty shelves or a shopping mall in decline. Like, we knew this was going to happen. Childcare providers have been sounding this alarm for some time. And as, you know, as Corrine was saying, as these childcare accounts payments are reduced, this is exactly what's happening. The world is not as it was before COVID. And even then, the private market for childcare didn't work. And now it's absolutely broken. We can see, you know, this direct link between maternal workforce participation and the supply of childcare. And Wisconsin now is seeing its lowest women's workforce participation since the 80s. So as we have a decline in childcare that's available and affordable, less women are entering and staying in the workforce. And that is costing the state probably as much money as it would cost to just invest in the early care and education sector.
We are talking about difficulties facing childcare in Wisconsin after a new report showing a lot of capacity at childcare centers, not for good reasons, because they can't find enough staff or because costs are high enough, as we're hearing, to say parents can't afford it. We've got Paula Drew with the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association with us. Corrine Hendrickson, operator of Corrine's Little Explorers in New Glarus. Corrine, another challenge that came out of this report is unpredictability of when parents are going to need help. So family A might need 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. every week, every weekday. Parent B might need only holidays and days off. Another one might have an unpredictable schedule. Their needs vary from day to day. Is this a challenge when it comes to scheduling and staffing a child care?
Yes, absolutely. As more and more people have more flexible work options or are basically going into their employers and saying, look, I can only afford to pay for childcare 3 days a week. So I'm only working, you know, 3 days a week. But then they're coming to us and we can't fill that whole slot because what happens is that parent isn't needing the consistent day. So let's say they work as a nurse and their shift isn't every Monday, Wednesday, Friday. It varies throughout the week. And so that child still has to have a full-time spot because we can't fill the other spots in consistently. And we can't be over ratio for good reason, the health and safety of these children. Also, young children really need consistency of care. And so those of us who do accept part-time, we would like the days to be in a row because that's what's best and best for the children and their development. And so that's part of an issue too, because, you know, it's really difficult for us to communicate that to parents and for them to understand, but I only need these days this week and these days this week. I'm like, but how do I fill in the other days so that I can operate fully, maintain, you know, my revenue that I need to maintain, but then also make it so that you can spend time with your own child, because that's also part of why people are wanting to do, you know, more part-time work or flexible scheduling, because they want to be able to spend more time with their children during these years. So we really need to be looking at how we invest as you know, not necessarily a per child, or because I don't like to call it slots, them slots, I should say, it's per child. Sorry, I have a child in the bathroom.
That's fine.
and so we really need to look at, what does this program need to operate? How much do they need for their basic program, you know, the building, the utilities, the food? How much do they need to pay their employees a livable wage and benefits? Because that's another thing we're finding is people, family child care in Wisconsin, the average age is like 54. A lot of our people have been doing this for a long time. They're 70, they're almost 80, and they can't retire because they have no retirement. And so we are asking people to work almost until they die in this field. And that's not fair. And that's not something that we as a society should be expecting of anyone. And so we really need to look at this holistically and look at, we need to create a system that works for the parents, that works for the children, and works for our community, so that our employers have the available workforce that they need right now. And then also in the future, we're building these brains. 90% of that brain development happens in these early years, and it's relationship, and it's one-on-one and trusting, caring environments. And so that is making the workforce for tomorrow. And that reduces costs for K-12. It reduces crime. You want to reduce crime? Invest in early childhood. It is like the easiest way to do it. And there's police officer groups that are getting more and more vocal. Invest in kids, not crime, is one of them. And they're really coming back and saying, look, all of these things come back to our broken communities and our broken child care system.
And we'll leave it there. Corrine, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And Paula, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely.
We've been talking about child care in Wisconsin with Paula Drew, who directs early care and education policy and research for the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association, and Corrine Hendrickson, family child care provider based in New Glarus. She operates Corrine's Little Explorers and provides preschool services and full-time child care and education. Is this the story of your life we're talking about right now, whether you provide child care or as a family, you need it? Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, a Wisconsin professor and her students tackle presidential campaign rhetoric and find out how to evaluate political claims.
This is a world in which you're living, and as a citizen, I would argue it's your job and your duty to be well informed.
Find out more. That's ahead on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the election draws closer, people across the state are getting inundated with ads and campaign messages as candidates seek to court voters in the final push.
A class at UW-Madison has been watching those ads closely. It's a course about presidential rhetoric taught by Professor Allison Prash from the Communications Department.
Throughout the semester, students have been tracking how the presidential candidates are talking about political issues and framing their messages for different audiences.
Producers Rochelle Wilson and Royce Podestro went to class to talk to the students about their perspectives as first-time voters. We'll hear from them. And last week, I talked to the professor about her takeaways as the semester and campaign unfold. Allison Prash is Associate Professor of Rhetoric, Politics, and Culture in the Department of Communication Arts at UW-Madison. Allison, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is your approach to teaching a class like this about presidential rhetoric when, you know, it's not like an abstract concept, it's actually happening right now?
Well, I would say first and foremost, my goal for students is to help them feel like they can engage in the discourse as informed citizens. So I set it up for them and say, my job here and our job together is to be curious and to seek to learn together. And then throughout the semester, we look at various pieces of discourse. So we start by looking at the candidates' acceptance speeches at the RNC and the DNC, and we start tracing themes and then follow those themes throughout the presidential debates, campaign messaging, even the ads. And, you know, moving up to Election Day, we're paying really close attention to how both candidates are trying to win over voters in the final days.
We're going to hear some of the voices of your students in just a bit. Big picture, though, you've got a front row seat to a group of young in many cases, I'm guessing, first-time voters. Tell us a little bit about the students in this class.
Well, in this class, we have 113 students from UW-Madison. The majority of these are juniors and seniors. And so I think it's really interesting to note, and I think about this a lot in my teaching and my preparation, is that for them, if they're first-time voters in 2024, that means that in the 2016 election, they were 11 or 12. And perhaps the first presidential election they remember, they were 7 or 8 in 2012. And so it's a fascinating opportunity for them to engage in a new way as voters.
Apart from making me feel old, one significant thing there is for many voters, I think, whether they like him or not, Donald Trump was something new and very different than what they were used to in American politics. And this is his third presidential election. This is the norm, I guess, for some of your students.
Well, it is. Again, if you are 11 or 12 in 2016, that is your entire political memory. And so one of the things that I've tried to do throughout the semester is really acknowledge the political force that Donald Trump has been, but also give students examples of previous elections. So we've spent a lot of time thinking about the Reagan campaign, for example, or the Clinton campaign, or even George W. Bush and Barack Obama. So they have a little bit more historical perspective on what campaigns have been like, while also acknowledging the moment in which we're living.
A couple of our producers on Wisconsin Today talked to a bunch of your students. We've got some excerpts from that. I want to start with Violet from Burlington, not the Wisconsin one, Burlington, Vermont, who said she found the candidate's speeches to be lacking in substance. Here's a listen.
Listening to the speeches, it's so crazy to just see how the candidates are using language to just appeal to such specific groups of people. And like, they honestly don't really even say that much in their speeches. It's really just the way they're saying it.
So do you hear this a lot from your students about style versus substance?
We do, and it's something that we've spent a lot of time analyzing. We talk a lot about the various audiences that the candidates are seeking to appeal to, and so some of that comes out in the issues they talk about, whether it's abortion or immigration or the economy. But I think I also see from students overall that they are frustrated by the lack of specifics or lack of clear policy, and we have a lot of conversations about what would that look like for you, what would make you feel more satisfied with the answers, and it's something that the students are really identifying.
Okay, now maybe we'll get that kind of information at a debate. Well, we heard from Anna from Berlin, Wisconsin, and Kendra from Toma. They told us about their experience watching the one presidential debate this year. Here is what they had to say about it.
We did a little watch party of the debate in our floor.
How was that?
We got to see a lot of conflicting views, but I think it was interesting.
There was a lot of yelling at the TV.
Apparently, we don't like debates because they just skirt around the topic. Everybody just wanted to get there and get done with the topic. They were like, can we answer it?
I'm guessing people of all ages might have been yelling at the TV at some point during the debate. Can you talk more about what your class, what your students took away from the debate?
Yeah, well, we watched with great interest and in great detail both snippets from the presidential debate and the vice presidential debate. And what was so fascinating to me is that students, after the fact of the presidential debate between Harris and Trump, they talked a lot about what you just heard expressed, wishing that there were more substantive policy discussions, or also feeling like it was an exercise in how to jab each other, essentially. What I found fascinating is that after the vice presidential debate, students were amazed. They said, I didn't even know that a debate could sound like this because there can be a substantive discussion of issues. They also pointed to the fact that there were these moments in which both vice presidential candidates were saying, you know, I agree with you on that. And they said that was really actually heartening to them to recognize that perhaps there could be moments of U.S. policy in which candidates agree. And they said, I wish we could see more of that.
And then, no surprise, politics can feel like a very negative thing anytime. I think now more so than usual, polarization, cynicism. How do your students talk about that?
They're concerned about it and they're frustrated about it. And if there is one thing that is contributing to this sense of political fatigue, it is that polarization. But the other thing that I would say is I am heartened by the desire they have to understand, the skills that they're learning in the class and that they just bring to the class already of how to be thoughtful listeners, how to engage with the discourse in a thoughtful, critical way, and to also express what they want to see differently about the discourse and what they would like the candidates to do to change the political environment.
We're talking about student perspectives on the election with Allison Prash, professor of rhetoric and politics at UW-Madison. She's teaching a class this semester about presidential rhetoric. Now, we asked students about their top issues this election season. A few different themes emerge. Let's start with one from Violet.
I feel like there's just so much on the line. Like, to be honest, my top issue is just making sure that democracy stays in place. I mean, I just think that should be like at the center of it all, because no other issues matter if we're not living in a functioning democracy, I feel like.
And Violet, I understand, wasn't the only one who offered that as their main concern. How do you see your students, hear your students talking about that?
You know, I would go back to the fact that for them, the political norms are very different than we might think of them in other generations. And so we have had clear discussions about what various candidates say about the state of democracy, the future of democracy, and what both candidates represent to various voters. And so it is something that's top of mind, specifically if you think about January 6th and the implications of that. And for those students who in 2020, you know, were perhaps in high school, that's something that's really concerning to them.
Is that something that's going to be their first big political memory, January 6th? For some students, anyway?
I think so. I also did a survey of students to say, what's your earliest political memory? And almost across the board, students would talk about the mock elections they maybe did in first or second grade and having real clear memories of those elections. And so what I talk with my students about is that those early political memories, whether that's in kindergarten, casting your you know, pretend ballot, or if it's these moments of national trauma and uncertainty, that really does shape how voters will approach this election and the candidates that they're interested in voting for.
Getting back to your students now, reproductive rights are a big issue this election season. Here's what we heard from Hannah and Madeline from Minneapolis.
Probably abortion rights, because as a female, I think it's important to value not just for us, but also our mothers and then our kids later on.
Yeah, I agree. I think abortion rights and just human rights in general are a huge issue and very important in this election year, especially with the candidates that are up for this year. Yeah.
I understand, Allison, earlier this week you polled the students to ask them about what the term abortion means to them. What kind of things did you hear?
Well, we had that conversation because what I was trying to emphasize for students is when we say the word abortion, it's about so many other things beyond just the word abortion. A lot of students are talking about the freedom to make choices for their own bodies and their futures. Students also talk about the tension between religious conviction and the ability to make those choices. There's concern about access to health care, and also the idea of, you know, what is the government's role in making decisions for individuals in all areas of life beyond the issue of abortion? But what is striking to me is that students, I think if we're going to talk about first political memories, it could be January 6th, but it also could be the overturning of Roe v. Wade and what that means in very practical terms and very personal terms for many students. And that is viscerally felt with students in my class.
College campuses around the country, including UW-Madison, UW-Milwaukee, have seen students demonstrating to express their support for Palestine. We got a message from a student named Summer, who we didn't get a chance to record, but we've got that message read by our producer, Rochelle.
As a Palestinian-American student, I'm deeply discouraged by the 2024 presidential election due to the ongoing genocide in Palestine, in which U.S. leadership continues to be complicit. The silence from U.S. leaders has left many of us questioning our place as voters. Until Vice President Harris addresses the atrocities in Gaza, I and others like me will remain uncommitted. We hope our voices will be heard in the fight for justice and human rights.
Another contentious issue for sure. How has your class been talking and thinking about the war in Gaza?
Well, is that, you know, example demonstrates this is a deeply personal issue to many students, and it's a difficult one to talk through because you have, yes, voices of Palestinian American students, you have a large population of Jewish students on campus, and so it is a really difficult issue. The way that I've chosen to approach it in my class is, again, to talk about the nuance and the complexity. I think it's easy to see issues as simple, and we know that it's much more complex. But I think what that student is expressing is the fact that there hasn't been much discussion by either candidate about the specifics of what they might do to bring about a ceasefire. And we know, especially in younger college voters, this is something that is of deep concern.
Is this fitting into that theme we mentioned earlier of your students being hungry for more detail on any issue, more substantive detail on any issue?
It is. It is. And I think, you know, if we're going to have a conversation more broadly about what this individual experience or this classroom tells us more broadly about college voters, I think one of the things is that politicians underestimate the information they want, their desire to be politically active, and their understanding that key issues such as climate change or reproductive rights or the war in Gaza, these are deeply felt issues by college students, and they are hungry for more information because they're recognizing the significance of voting for the first time and what that means to them.
Another student we heard from, Dylan in Fort Lauderdale, who said his top issue is fixing what he sees as a broken political system. He said his other top issues are climate change and gun violence. Here's a listen.
I've grown up in a generation that has had to do active shooter drills and has had to stare down intensifying hurricanes and intensifying storms. And Donald Trump calls climate change a hoax.
Those are often cited as big issues for Gen Z. How do you see this impacting their view of the presidential race?
It's something that is deeply concerning to them. And again, one of the conversations I had with my students after the presidential debate is how frustrated they were that there wasn't a substantive discussion about climate change or really an acknowledgement of it. And I think if we're thinking about political fatigue, one of the things that's interesting to these student discussions is the fact that they are frustrated and angry, not just by the candidates, but also other people in positions of political power who they say, you're out of touch with the real issues that we're going to have to live through and that are going to affect our lives and our children's lives. And really this this uncertainty if their futures are seen and held in the same importance that previous generations' futures have been.
Staying with that generational concern, we asked students what they wish politicians and the public knew about Gen Z. And a common theme our producers found was that they don't feel as politically extreme as they're sometimes portrayed to be. Here's a student named Anna.
People should know that we are out there, but we're not quite as far out there as they think. We still want human rights, too. It's not like we're crazy voting for aliens.
The way Gen Z perceives other generations as perceiving them. What do you see there?
That's a great question. I think what I see in my classroom and in these small group discussions with students is kind of a frustration with maybe the assumption that all the news they get are these individual bits and pieces or that they're not really engaged. And so I think it expresses this real frustration that they don't have a voice or they don't have insight. And in fact, I'm learning from them every day.
Staying with what they want from politicians, Lily from Watertown, we'll give a listen, says getting back to civil dialogue is her top political issue.
I think for me, it's just getting back to a place where we're able to compromise and just coexist with each other across political lines. I feel like today, everyone's their politics are part of their identity, which is totally fine. But I think people are getting very defensive and are unwilling to kind of have conversations across the board with that. So I really want to see a step towards compromise is really big for me.
Lily, putting her finger on a pulse there, I hear that from a lot of longtime political watchdogs, the idea that our politics has become, as Lily said, part of our identity, and we're on Team A or Team B here. Pretty perceptive from your student there.
It is, and it speaks to, I think, the broad polarization, but almost this description of political identity, specifically here in the United States, as a team sport. And there is someone who wins and someone who loses. And I think we are all at a disservice when we approach it that way. I think that's one of the reasons, again, that my students were so excited, quite frankly, to listen to the vice presidential debate and to realize that maybe there could be points of connection or agreement. Because, again, I think if they're only political understanding has been the last 8 years or 10 years where polarization has rapidly increased. They're tired of that. And they're also thinking about, is this going to be my political reality for the next 50 years? I don't want to live in this environment.
People around the state might listen and hear a class at UW-Madison and think, well, this is going to be a bunch of far-left students. What do you see?
It's not. One of the things I've done very strategically in the class is done many anonymous surveys. And so students will, they can do it on their phone or their laptop during class and ask them what they think about particular issues. And we have a pretty even demographic of students who lean, you know, more liberal, more conservative. They're very active at expressing their voices. I do it anonymously most often because I want to make sure that students feel welcome to engage in debate and share those issues, but it's pretty representative across the board.
The election is coming up next week. No matter what the results, there's going to be emotions. People are going to be happy, sad, devastated, I don't know, or we might not know a result in key races by the time that next class happens. What is your plan for the first class after Election Day?
So our first class after Election Day will be on that Thursday, okay, November 7th. So our plan is to, you know, obviously I'll be asking them to watch the results of the election. And depending on if we know results, if we have, you know, state by state or more nationally, we'll talk about the discourse that is shaping our understanding of the election and its significance. If we don't have, you know, a declared winner by then, what I'll ask them to do over the weekend is to think about how that makes them feel as voters, how politicians are talking about it, how the candidates are trying to frame or shape the message. Because again, the goal in our class is to help them analyze how these messages are curated for a larger audience and then the ethics of how that happens.
Allison, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Allison Prash, Associate Professor of Rhetoric, Politics, and Culture in the Department of Communication Arts at UW-Madison. We've been talking about her class on presidential rhetoric this semester and the issues that matter to Gen Z students, many of whom will be voting for the first time this year, plus how any of us can look at and think about campaign rhetoric as we head toward Election Day.
Coming up, a mindfulness instructor in Appleton shares advice for caregivers and others.
I think we all intellectually know that if we don't take good enough care of ourselves, we can't take good care of other people.
That's just ahead here on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Family caregivers in Wisconsin provide more than 540 million unpaid hours to their loved ones. That's according to an analysis by AARP.
In Northeast Wisconsin, the Broward County Caregiver Coalition is hosting an upcoming event to guide caregivers to wellness. The nonprofit organization recognizes the stress people can undergo as caregivers.
This Saturday, participants can learn how to balance what to do for themselves and others, including lessons on mindfulness.
This year's keynote speaker is a Wisconsinite who teaches mindfulness for businesses, schools, nonprofits, prisons, and other organizations. Joy Jordan of Appleton joins us now to share more insight on this work. Joy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Rob, it's great to be here.
I want to start with the word mindfulness. We'll be using it a lot, and I think people probably hear it a lot, but they may not be mindful of what it means. What do we mean when we say the word mindfulness?
Mindfulness is an awareness of our own thoughts and emotions and body sensations as they're happening. And the awareness has some curiosity to it, some kindness. Ways in which we are not mindful, this sometimes is helpful to name, is when we're totally lost in our thoughts. So there's no space between us and the thoughts. We're just lost in the movie of our mind. Or we may be aware of our thoughts. There's some space between them, but we don't like what's happening in our internal experience. And we add a lot of tension and pain to that. So mindfulness is awareness of our internal state with some kindness added.
I want to talk about your path to becoming someone who teaches mindfulness in so many different venues, because you came from a job as a statistics professor. How did you get from point A to point B?
Well, while I was a statistics professor, meditation and mindfulness were vital to my well-being. And they were also helpful to me making a career change. After 14 years as a statistics professor, I knew I needed to make a shift. I loved teaching. I just needed to shift what I was teaching. And because I'd had such a positive experiences with the practices of meditation and mindfulness, I decided to shift into bringing my teaching skills to this thing I've been doing for 20 years that's radically changed my life in positive ways.
I think I'm probably like a lot of people in that, okay, if I don't want to go into my thoughts like that, I don't turn to mindfulness. I turn to something to distract me from it, right? Background noise, a computer game, whatever. What's the value of saying, no, don't distract yourself from that path your brain is on, but to really engage with it in a mindful way?
Well, we have a lot of habits, mind habits that are not skillful. The distraction habit is strong, but we don't often feel good when we do that. Ultimately, it can lead to more tension in our minds and our bodies. It can lead to more stress, to disease. And it's helpful to have other ways of skillfully navigating. Distractions are helpful, Rob. I use them too. But if we're constantly distracting, we're not actually engaging. And we're not as happy because we're not as present in our life. We're always looking for something to be different. And the practice of mindfulness lets us realize we can be with what is, and it is okay. And that's a vital well-being skill.
Well, what caught my attention is you're going to be talking at an event for the Brown County Caregiver Coalition and sharing some of these lessons with people who are providing care to, you know, maybe a loved one or somebody in their community, whatever the case may be. How did you get involved in that, first of all?
Well, I have been here in Appleton, Wisconsin, where I live, been involved with folks who are taking care of people with dementia and Alzheimer's. And that's a full-time job, and it's very stressful. I just got hooked into that community. I've done a number of events, small and big. And then I got the call from Green Bay to do this event. And it's a beautiful event where they're really trying to help caregivers find their own wellness.
Something I hear again and again when I talk to caregivers or about caregivers, Joy, is, you know, they're so focused on the person they're giving care to, understandably, that they can lose track of their own needs and taking care of themselves. Why is that important for them to focus on?
I think we all intellectually know that if we don't take good enough care of ourselves, we can't take good care of other people. I think we all know that, but we don't always practice it. I think there can be some really strong internal expectations that we have of ourselves and sometimes societal expectations about what we should be doing. But the reality is we will lose our patience. We will not be as loving. We will perhaps be resentful if we do not take care of ourselves. And that can translate outward to the folks that we're caregiving to. And so these are all good reasons to try, for example, mindfulness and other things that you can try to be more well. And they can happen in small doses. It doesn't mean you have to sit down and meditate for 20 minutes. I'm a big proponent of small, regular pauses throughout the day.
For a caregiver, maybe a Midwestern caregiver, if I can embrace a stereotype here, another obstacle might be we feel guilty, right? The priority is the other person, and I don't want to be a bother. I don't want to focus on me and my problems when there's somebody, you know, suffering, dealing with much more. How do we get past that so we get to that point of that needed, I hate to use the phrase self-care, but self-care, we'll call it for now.
I think mindfulness can help to recognize when that guilt arises. Sometimes we're not even aware that the guilt is present and what it does to us. And if we're sort of weighed down by that guilt, again, we're not able to help the person right in front of us. The reality is all of us have difficulty and struggles. And if we minimize our own and elevate everybody else's, we're not able to love and be patient and be compassionate in the ways that are helpful. So just at a practical level, you won't be as good of a caregiver if you're not taking care of yourself. That's just a fact. And it's hard to take in with that Midwestern guilt. I agree, mm-hmm. Rob. But it's like, just try it. Try one thing and notice that perhaps the sky doesn't fall, that everything is okay still when you can take care of yourself at the same time.
We're talking to Joy Jordan, mindfulness teacher, trainer, and coach based in Appleton, doing an event with the Brown County Caregiver Coalition. That's on Saturday, November 2nd. Let's put this into action, Joy. A caregiver is out there. We know it's difficult work. We don't have to imagine that scenario too strongly. How can they get started on making those moments for mindfulness, taking that pause, getting off autopilot for a moment? How do you recommend they get started?
I often talk about a three-breath pause whenever I'm teaching, and I know that sounds overly simplistic, but it really is helpful. Pause for three breaths. That's it. Don't make it bigger than that. Take three deep breaths between activities, between actions, between things that you're doing. And I also like to find regular places that we already pause in our life and utilize those. So, for example, if you're driving someone around to different appointments, you're in the car and you come to a red light. Often we think red lights are getting in our way. You could actually view the red light as a thing in your life that's encouraging you to stop, to pause, take your hands off the wheel, relax your shoulders, and practice mindfulness. How are you in that moment? Another place you can pause is when you're outside, maybe just taking a quick walk around the block or step outside your house. Look up at the sky for three breaths. Looking at the sky engages us with a microdose of awe, and awe has been related to happiness and well-being. Look at the stars, look at the clouds. Remember that you're part of something bigger. And one other quick thing is in that pause is maybe practice what's called straw breathing. Those of you listening could do it right now. Breathe in through your nose. And then when you breathe out through your mouth like you're blowing through an imaginary straw. So it's in through your nose and then blow out through your mouth like you're blowing through a straw. And try to make that breathing out longer and longer and longer. And then that engages the parasympathetic nervous system, which is our rest, relax system. It's a stealth meditation, straw breathing. Try it throughout the day.
Now, you're doing this for caregivers. You do this in a lot of other, these mindfulness trainings in a lot of other venues as well, including workplaces. Now, I know, depending on somebody's job, those moments are something to be scared of and suspicious of, right? We're go, go, go. If I'm on the radio, I can't pause for three breaths. That's dead air. How can we, when we're in that go, go, go mindset, make ourselves reset and take those pauses?
Well, I understand, Rob, you have a very special job where the dead air is not helpful. But I think in general, that sense of urgency in the workplace is more heightened than is needed. There is space for the three-breath pause, or there is space to perhaps not immediately respond within seconds to some message you get. You could sit and take a deep breath, especially if it's a conversation that you really want to put some thought into. I think people are actually looking for spaces. If someone creates a space, takes a pause, takes a breath, the other person feels some relief that this is possible, that we don't always have to be going from a place of urgency. And there's some relief in that. And it doesn't have to be, like I said, for 20 minutes you take a break. It really can be a 30-second three-breath pause to reset.
Something else that struck me about the work you do is that you've done trainings, I believe, in prisons. Can you talk about the sorts of things that you've taught there and the value of doing that?
Oh, I love my work in prison. It is so meaningful and inspiring. I go into Oshkosh Correctional Institution and lead a secular mindfulness group there. It's a group, and we also do one-on-one visits. So it's the residents there at Oshkosh teaching them these skills of meditation and mindfulness. One of the biggest things that empowers the folks in prison is to see the space, that they don't need to react, that they can respond. And especially with flashes of anger, that pause is a miracle and gives people choice and ultimately freedom, even if they're still in prison, a sense of freedom internally when they're working with these mindfulness practices.
And then you've also done work in schools. What are kids taking away from some mindfulness practice?
Well, the work I often do in school is with teachers and staff.
Oh, okay.
Which I
even
love
better
teachers. But I have done some work, too, with the littles, bringing the kindness curriculum from the Center for Healthy Mind into the pre-K classrooms and getting kids, really young kids, to listen to the sound of a bell or feel their belly go up and down as they breathe or do something kind for somebody else. There's a lot we can bring into the schools for the kids and the teachers. The teachers, wow, they are doing such amazing work. I love teachers. And again, it's these short pauses because we know what their day looked like. But if they could do straw breathing for themselves or with their kids, that's something. A lot of these breath practices can be brought to the students to start to create a little bit of sense of calm.
I think sometimes there's a stereotype of meditation, mindfulness, that it's self-centered, right? It's you're taking care of yourself. But I hear again and again when I talk to people who actually do it and practice it, no, it is very much focusing on other people with that kindness in the way you just mentioned.
Absolutely. So every morning I sit in meditation and I am doing that on my own. I am training my mindfulness of my internal state. But my motivation for doing it, Rob, is so that I interact with my loved ones, my friends, my clients, strangers. So I interact with them with more patience and compassion and understanding.
You've mentioned a couple times mindfulness and meditation doesn't have to be a long session. It can be that take a pause for 30 seconds. But if somebody's interested in expanding that, how do you recommend they get that started, especially someone, I don't know, like me, who's a little fidgety mentally and physically to take that space and meditate?
Great question, Rob. And that mentally and physically fidgety, I think a lot of people will raise their hand on that. The reality is we're not trying to stop our thoughts or make it so our body is completely still. I think there's a lot of myths around what a good meditation looks like. The reality isn't there isn't any right or wrong to it. We're simply trying to pay attention to something, say our breath, and then notice when we get distracted and then return to our breath. Start small, set a timer for 5 minutes. Try to notice your breath, the in-breath, the out-breath. You'll get distracted. And whenever you notice that, you just come back again to your breath. The timer goes off. Great. Whatever happened, happened. Doesn't have to be longer than that. If you really want some help, there's a lot of meditation apps, including the Center for Healthy Mind has a free meditation app that people can get that you can get some guidance in the process. But I think keeping it simple and not having huge expectations is going to be the way to go.
As we wrap up, Joy, I want to bring this back to caregivers. I know there are a bunch of them listening right now. Can you speak directly to them to encourage them to take those at least moments of mindfulness?
Absolutely. I just want to reiterate that for you caregivers, taking care of you is a really important part of taking care of your loved ones, without question. And one thing I'll add here that is specific to caregivers is compassion meditation can be very helpful. And that's where you're actually repeating phrases to yourself. For example, when you're looking at your loved one, I care about your struggles, yet cannot take them away from you. Or I wish you happiness and peace, yet cannot make your choices for you. So there's this sense of caring for people, but recognizing our limitations. And sometimes those kind of phrases can keep you going through a long day.
Joy, thanks so much for sharing your work with us today.
Thank you so much, Rob, for what you do.
Joy Jordan is a mindfulness teacher, trainer, and coach based in Appleton. She's speaking at an event for the Brown County Caregiver Coalition that's coming up this Saturday.
We are down to costume crunch time with Halloween on Thursday, and we want to check in to see if you're making one or getting a costume off the shelf.
Share with us about your costumes, how they came together this year, or the ones you've created for a child.
And Rob, the trickiest part is getting that kiddo to stay committed to their costume decision through Thursday evening. I've had plenty of those 11th hour costume 180s over the years, and those are not fun.
Well, good news in the weather for you at least, Kate. It looks like there won't be a lot of puffy jackets to hide those amazing costumes this year.
Yes, that is a plus. No knee-deep snow to contend with. Call or text about your Halloween costume successes and costume debacles. We'll hear them. The number is 888-642-0232 or email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.